This is the Reason interview. Thanks for listening. This is the audio version of a video live stream that takes place every Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Go to reason.com to check that out in real time or to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/ReasonTV. The topic this week was whether falling birth rates in the United States and other countries are a bad thing that governments should try to reverse. Nick's guests were Reason senior editor Elizabeth Nolan Brown, whose June cover story is Storks Don't Take Orders from the State, and Scott Winship, who runs the American Enterprise Institute Center on Opportunity and Social Mobility, and has written widely on the myths and realities about economic and cultural decline. They spoke about whether past government policies have proven effective in changing birth rates, whether the state should be involved in such decisions from a moral perspective, and why the right and left are increasingly committed to pronatalist policies. Here's the recent interview with Elizabeth Nolan Brown and Scott Winship.
Scott, Liz, thanks for talking to Reason.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So today what we are talking about is one of, you know, there's the AI panic, but there's a deeper, longer lived kind of rolling panic, which probably has something to do with AI as well. But that's fears that we are not producing enough children, particularly in the U.S., but this is something that comes and goes in waves all over the globe, particularly in Western Europe. 50 years ago or thereabouts, obviously the fear was that we were having too many children, particularly in bad parts of the world, by which I mean third world countries, China, India, and that we were going to be overrun by poor, starving people who would be pissed off. Now the problem is that even in those countries, we're seeing declining fertility rates, and this has given rise to a new conversation about how do we increase fertility rates or the number of children that women have. Liz Nolan Brown, in the most recent issue of Reason, has a great story called "Storks Don't Take Orders from the State." At first, I thought this was a the long-awaited Vlasic Pickle special issue that we had been talking about, but it's not that. But let's start with Liz. Give a basic summary of what is your story about?
It's about falling fertility rates in the U.S. and around the world. Pretty much, more than half of the countries in the world have below replacement level fertility, which is 2.1 kids per woman. Some of them quite a bit below. The United States is at 1.66, which puts us kind of on par with a whole lot of European countries and above a lot of the very low countries. So it sort of looks at why fertility rates have been falling, a little bit of the good reasons for that, but also the negative things associated with that. It looks at a lot of the theories as to why fertility rates are falling, and then sort of tears them all apart, because when you look at the global data, it doesn't really lend itself to any of the sort of popular explanations that come from either the right or the left in the United States.
And again, this is when we know we're in a full blown panic, because people on the right and the left, sometimes for the same reasons, but also often for, you know, different reasons, are like, oh my God, this is now officially an issue. Typically, if it's just the right or it's just the left, you're like, okay, we're in the gestation period. I'm sorry to use pregnancy related metaphors throughout this conversation, but it's like, okay, this is just for cheap political opportunity. But this now has, you know, it's entered the bloodstream, right? Because both the right and the left are like, oh my God, we're not having enough babies. What is the, what was your main finding of, because this is a global phenomenon, and it's something that is actually, I mean, if you take a longer view, it's like basically for hundreds of years, in general, there's been a very broadly observed correlation that as countries become richer and more industrialized, they have fewer kids. But what is driving the decline in birth rates, Liz?
I think the main findings were two things, neither of which answers your question of what is driving the decline, because that's sort of a mystery unless we just say individual choice in general. But the main findings, I think, were that, pronatalist policies, government policies intended to boost birth rates don't work, whether that's, you know, bribing people to have more kids with, you know, various tax incentives or direct cash payments or all sorts of subsidies or just sort of patriotic campaigns like Russia gave people like several days off work to like make babies. None of that works. And then the other main finding is that, like I said, just, you know, a lot of these explanations you have, you know, on the right, things like we're not valuing motherhood enough or too many women are working or, you know, we just have, you know, there's all these selfish single millennial women who don't want to have kids and are being childless. And on the left, you have all these, you know, more economic explanations. We need more government subsidies for childcare.
Yeah, it's just too expensive to have kids, right?
And when you look at other countries, these things just don't, not none of these explanations really pan out.
Right. Because in some countries, you know, women are given a lot of money to have kids and others they're not. And there just doesn't seem to be a strong correlation.
Correct.
Between that. And one of the things in your story that is available online at reason.com points out is, you know, there was a kind of plausible notion that, you know, with the baby boom after World War II, women kind of left the workforce from a certain peak during the war years because everybody was working, you know, either fighting or working in factories. When they pulled out of the labor force a little bit, they had more kids and people were like, oh, this is the thing. But then as women entered the work, you know, at various points, women entering the workforce, they had fewer kids or they enter the workforce even more and they have more kids. So it's just the data really, you know, the only thing we know for sure is that women are having fewer kids.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
And Scott, your work, and I really want to recommend everything that you do at the at the Center on Opportunity and Social Mobility. I'm a big fan of it, of your work, particularly because, and we've talked at various times over the years about it, you stand athwart decline narratives or declension narratives where people are saying things are just going to hell in a handbasket. And you say, you know, no, not really. One of your findings is that, you know, one of the reasons why we're having fewer children is because women want fewer children. What goes into that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if you look at the grand sweep of history, Liz's piece mentions this. You know, there's been this, I don't know, over 100-year decline in fertility, with the exception of the baby boom that we can sort of come back to, which I think is a more interesting story than a lot of people realize. But yeah, essentially, apart from the baby boom and then, you know, a small recovery more recently before the Great Recession, it's just been down and fertility dropped the most during the 1970s, which not coincidentally at all was the big decade for women's labor force participation rising. That was, you know, the generation of boomer women who had opportunities that opened up that weren't there before. It coincides with increasing educational attainment on the part of women, later marriage, more divorce. And as Liz's piece notes, you know, these are sort of trends that are common to rich countries around the world. It's kind of modernity. And at the same time that we've seen these declines in fertility, you know, there is empirical evidence suggesting that women want fewer kids than they did in the past. So I wrote a piece, boy, I guess a couple of years ago at this point, which is crazy, where it actually asked people women when they were in their late teens, how many kids do you expect to have? In one of the surveys, how many kids do you want to have? And that's gone down over time. It's basically gone down, you know, in line with how much actual fertility has gone down. This was sort of comparing the youngest boomers to the oldest millennials. So essentially what we're looking at is, I think, a change in preferences, and it will have consequences, I think, that Liz talks about. But we tend to forget, you know, if the decline is the result of preferences for fewer kids, that's a very different story, and it implies benefits that have to be weighed against these costs, than if the story is, well, people want the same number of kids, it's just they can't afford to have them anymore.
I would say people will always point to these surveys that, you know, will show still millennial and Gen X women saying, you know, the ideal number of children is two. But I think, you know, as I talk about in there too, you know, a lot of those surveys are asked when people are fairly young and, you know, people change. Like surveys do show that when people are younger, they tend to say they want more kids. And then that changes when they get older because, you know, they have a kid or two and then it's, and then it's difficult or expensive, or they just get other priorities in their life, or, you know, something doesn't work out in their marriage. Just a billion different reasons why people might, you know, when they're 20, say they want four kids, and then by the time they're 30, realize they don't. And that doesn't mean that they failed in their fertility goals. It just means they changed their mind.
These questions, you know, get posed to 18-year-olds without any kind of like trade-offs, right? They're not like, all right, what would you give up to have the two kids that you would like to have? Are you willing to, you know, live in a less glamorous suburb with a smaller house so that you can save up more to afford these kids and give up?
Are you willing to spend 20 years watching Nickelodeon and whatever succeeded Disney, you know, channel for kids, you know, for 20 years?
Same episode of Phineas and Ferb over and over and over.
And I want to point out for skeptics, all of us here have done our share to keep the planet populated, which, you know, and I'm older than you guys, and I'm old enough to remember when humanity was the problem, when overpopulation was the problem. And so I feel bad. I have two children and, you know, God, I haven't helped the environment by, you know, shutting down the my evolutionary stream. Let's, before we go to the question of whether or not there are government policies that can actually increase fertility rates. And, you know, Liz, you mentioned, you know, like, you know, it's a mixed sword, right? Or a mixed message when you say something like, even Stalin couldn't get Russian women to have more kids, because it's like, obviously, the Soviet Union and communism doesn't work. It doesn't work to, you know, create kids or anything. But it's kind of fascinating when a totalitarian leader is incapable of getting women to put out more, basically, right? This is, you know, in the crudest terms possible. But we'll talk about whether or not the state can do that and whether it should. But first, can we focus a little bit on the question of whether or not it's a, it, you know, how do you measure the costs and benefits of a falling fertility rate? And there, you know, there are one, you know, there's the images which are older now, because in places like China and India, the most populous countries in the world, birth rates are declining and populations are aging. But, you know, you have that as the bad sign. But then you have, you know, in a place like Japan, which I believe is the only country, only industrialized country that has fewer people now than in 2000. It has a famously aging population, et cetera. And the economy, you know, it's not clear that how tightly correlated any of this is. Japan has been in what's been called the lost decade for really the past 30 years, almost 40 years. But what are the negative consequences of a decline in birth rates or in population of a country? Scott, do you want to go first on that? Are there issues with that?
Yeah, so there are a lot of claims that are made, and I'm not an expert in this literature. You know, the big ones that you hear are it results in slower economic growth over time. Weirdly, that's often framed in terms of GDP rather than GDP per person. Like if we have fewer people or the growth in people is lower, like it's okay to have a lower growth in GDP as long as we don't have lower growth in GDP per person. You know, there's evidence that it reduces dynamism and innovation, entrepreneurship, things like that. I think there's big impacts on, for instance, senior entitlements to the extent that you've got a lot of retirees that are receiving Social Security, Medicare, and you don't have a lot of people who are paying taxes into the system. That creates some fiscal stress for sure. So I think there's, in some ways, some of it is just math. I think the entitlement problem, you know, is very real. Others, you know, are empirical questions. I don't think there's fantastic research for a lot of the claims. Yeah, I think it's clear that regions, states that that have lower fertility experience less dynamism than places that don't. But I don't. That doesn't necessarily translate, I think, into the future. But those are the ones you hear. I think Liz touches on all these on her piece. Yeah.
Liz, you are calling in from the southwestern Ohio region, Cincinnati, where I lived in Oxford for a number of years. And that part of Ohio in general, but that part of Ohio is an interesting example of a place where, you know, they're losing population relative to other parts of the country and whatnot. They don't have a lot of immigration to that, you know, to like the Cincinnati metro area. What do you see as, you know, you're in a part of the country which is kind of suffering from, you know, on a micro level, some of the issues where there are fewer people and the population is aging. Are there concerns with that that we should be thinking about and taking seriously?
I mean, in terms of just what I see around me, I can't really, it's hard to speak to it because Cincinnati and this whole area that I'm in is so much more dynamic now than it was 20 or 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of strange, even though the population.
But the lines at the Skechers stores in the mall are just out the door.
They have to combine a lot of the Catholic schools because it's a big Catholic school area. There's tons of Catholic grade schools, like the one I went to, and like five others have all combined because there's much fewer. But I don't know if that could just also be fewer people in Catholic school than previously.
Right. Catholicism has not had a great 20 years, right?
No, it has not.
Yeah.
But I talked to this this guy from Khalifa University in the United Arab Emirates, Stuart Gaitel Boston, I'm probably butchering his name, who works on these issues a lot. And I thought his perspective on this was really interesting because he talks about how, you know, it could be an opportunity, like lower population, people focus on the doom aspects of it, but it could be an opportunity. And at any rate, we shouldn't just be the reason people want to raise birth rates and they're obsessed with it is because, well, population decline. Like instead of focusing on make more babies, we should be looking at the actual problems we're trying to solve, whether that's dynamism or like having to shift where people are in the labor, you know, force, or whether that's, you know, pension systems and old age entitlements, like, and fix those problems instead of trying to fix this proxy problem of the birth rates. Because even if we raise birth rates right now, we're still facing this massive aging population in the U.S. and so many other countries. And more babies right now even aren't going to change that.
Yeah. It's, you know, Jonathan Last, who was at the Weekly Standard and is now at the Dispatch or the Bulwark. I apologize for confusing. Bulwark, thank you. about 10 or 15 years ago, he wrote a very good book about this general problem called What to Expect When Nobody's Expecting. And, you know, kind of anticipating what both of you have said in different ways, it's that declining fertility rates or declining population is an artifact of modernity, of people having more money, more options, particularly more women. And I know he tied declines in fertility to essentially they correlate with the more years of education that women have available to them, which is a proxy for opportunity and autonomy. And so it does seem, and Scott, I think you even mentioned this, it's, you know, like the war on declining fertility. I mean, if it's going to become a war on modernity, that's kind of disturbing. But it also seems like a lot of critics, particularly on the right, seem to be like, yes, that is exactly the problem. How does one reach, you know, a person who is invested in the idea that, you know, and they can be male or female, you know, but saying, no, women need to be making more babies for the good of something?
Oh, no, I'll just start to just, you know, I think some surprising things that I learned doing this is that a lot of the assumptions baked into those sort of ideas are wrong. Like a lot of people just assume that, you know, low fertility rates are being driven by a rise in childlessness of women or couples just deciding that they don't want to have kids. And, you know, there's a stereotype on the right that it's just they're all, you know, too selfish and too busy with either their careers or having fun or whatever. But actually, you know, we're kind of on par with historic levels of childlessness, actually. The decline is much more driven by people just having smaller families. There's way fewer people having 4+ kids and way more having 1 or 2. So we've actually got more people having children than 30, 40 years ago even. But they're just having smaller families than they did once upon a time, which I think puts things in a different perspective.
Absolutely.
For sure. Yeah. No, I mean, what I've been trying to do really as a result of the child tax credit expansion debate from a couple of years ago is to try to force people to just confront the facts. And I think You know, I have a lot of friends who are social conservatives. A lot of them really would like to believe that the decline in fertility is in large measure because people still want the same number of kids. They just can't have them for some reason. If that's student loan debt, if it's like housing has gotten too expensive, you name it. There's some kind of economic factor behind it. And I just don't think the evidence is consistent with that. The paper that I wrote for the Dispatch a couple of years ago showed that the older millennials are no less likely to hit the fertility targets that they said they were shooting for at 18 than the youngest boomers were.
Yep. And actually, so, you found that they were a little bit closer to.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, boomers, or at least boomer women, wanted more kids than they achieved.
Yep.
Millennials were doing pretty good.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so I think social conservatives, I would hope, are sort of forced to confront this evidence that they would like to believe that the culture hasn't changed, that preferences haven't changed, and therefore there's an economic explanation that policy such as bumping up the child tax credit by a couple thousand dollars, increasing paid leave by this or that, can move the lever on some of this stuff. Because if it's just culture and it's preferences and modernity, you know, good luck with policy changing that. I think ultimately social conservatives, you know, this is a marketing campaign in the end for them. Like it's perfectly fine to want more kids and to think Americans should be having more kids, but that's a value position and you need to convince the rest of the country to think that way too.
It is fast. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, just it's funny that you say that this is the position of social conservatives too, because it's again the convergence of the left and the right on these things.
Right.
Because both of them have settled on this idea that, like, if only we could make, you know, give people more money in order to raise their kids.
That, yeah, and I want to get to that in a second, but you know, just to dilate first again, I apologize.
You're out of control, Nick.
the weirdness of the baby boom, and particularly the 1950s as a decade, that, you know, I think if you trace the kind of intellectual ideology of why do we look back to the 1950s as a decade of, you know, all positive stuff, it's really Bill Bennett and William Bennett and a bunch of social conservatives, people who were then called neoconservatives, often painted a picture of they needed to demonize the 1960s as the decade when everything went insane. And so they leapfrogged back over that. And this was starting in the late 70s and in the 80s. And they went, they talked specifically about the 1950s as this wonderful decade. It was a return to normalcy and there was broad prosperity. And they painted a picture in a series of works of you know, just a wonderful time when women left the workforce. You know, Rosie the Riveter turned out not to be a crypto lesbian, but she really wanted to go home and have like 8 kids. And, you know, Bill Bennett would talk about how, you know, teachers only complained that kids in school were chewing gum or talking in the halls during classes. And you know, divorce rates went down for the first time. And, you know, like in the past 150 or almost 200 years, divorce rates have been climbing, you know, except for in the 1950s. They painted this erroneous picture of a decade focusing on like kind of pro-family values moments. And then, of course, you know, elided the fact that rock music came out, then the Beats were everywhere. You know, people started doing drugs. The civil rights movement, there was so much anxiety about, you know, Johnny couldn't read and Sputnik was eating our lunch and we all got fat. It casts a long shadow because you have people looking back at an incredibly atypical decade that they are already mischaracterizing and then saying, why can't we do that? I look at, you know, various accounts on Twitter and, you know, God forbid that we mistake Twitter for reality, but there's a nostalgia for a kind of neo-50s-ism of like, where no, we can really go back to having 4 kids in a family and living in cul-de-sacs, etc., as if anybody really wants that. And I think until social conservatives kind of get over the idea that, A, that was never what it was, but it's not coming back, they'll be lost. And then the left, you know, is getting on this bandwagon of like, well, we need to, you know, we need to subsidize children more so that we get more of them, mostly so that they will fund Social Security and Medicare, which should not just be for old people, but for everybody. And I guess, on the heels of that, let's talk about some of the attempts by various governments, both now and in the past, to actually increase fertility. Liz, what did you find when you surveyed, you know, past and present attempts by specific societies to say, okay, you know what, we're going to crank up the baby-making machine?
I found that, it doesn't work. That some of the countries that have tried the hardest are South Korea, which has one of the lowest fertility rates in the world. I think it's 0.81 in 2021. So it's below one now. And also Singapore and Japan, very, very low. Singapore's is around 1.1 or 1.2. Singapore has tried so much. They give people preferential housing because, a lot of the housing is decided by the state. So they give people preferential housing if they have more kids. They gave people direct cash bonuses, $8,000, $10,000 for a first kid, more after that. They, subsidize childcare. They give subsidies to grandparents to move next to their kids. They've just tried basically everything that you can try. And it has not managed to raise their fertility rate. It's continued to fall over the past several decades. And that's the same story that you see in Japan. It's the same story that you see basically everywhere that has really, gone all in on these sort of pronatalist policies. And then to the same effect, some of them, aren't specifically portrayed as pronatalist policies, but say like Nordic countries where there is like subsidized leave, a lot of, guaranteed parental leave, subsidized childcare, women can stay home for a year or more after the kid. And they also have seen, birth rates just continue to fall over the past several decades.
Scott, have you found any places where these policies either seem to work or they kind of pay for themselves or something?
So I thought Liz's article did a great job summarizing the evidence. I've tended to sort of look to some of the more pronatalist folks out there who, would love to find policies that would move the needle and to sort of see what they say. So I think now's the time in the conversation that we ring the bell and invoke Lyman Stone.
Can you explain who he is?
Lyman Stone is a demographer. I think he's in grad school right now, getting an econ degree. Has written for, he was at AEI for a little while. He has an affiliation with the Institute for Family Studies, has written a lot about fertility trends, and is I think safe to say he's a pronatalist. I think he'd call himself that. He had a long Twitter response, which is kind of his modus operandi, to Liz's original piece when it came out. And what was interesting about it was, to me, was that he claimed, first of all, that 99% of that Liz ignored the programs that work was the first one. Second, that 99% of what's tried is too meager to have any impact. So I guess he's saying Liz missed the 1% of studies. And then third, that, as an example of something that, to be clear, he didn't endorse, but something that could move the needle was in Romania, where they outlawed birth control and abortion for
was under Ceausescu. So that's right. Yeah, at the peak of Ceausescu's glorious powers.
Yeah. So, for more than a decade, outlawing birth control and abortion for most of the population. And as far as I could tell, the claim was that maybe in the long run, they increased the total fertility rate by half a child. If that's sort of the best a totalitarian government can do, paid family leave is just not going to move the needle. I think Liz quotes somebody as saying, like, the amounts we're talking about versus how much it costs to raise a kid. The idea that a $3,000 child tax credit instead of a $2,000 child tax credit is going to suddenly reverse the trends just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, and I guess there's that issue of, like, even if it was $30,000, I mean, what, and I don't mean to put you guys individually on the spot, but, what would it take to put you in the position of having more kids? And Liz, you're actually, you have one child and you're pregnant with your second. What would it take for you to, to have triplets or something like that. And
I mean, I don't think there's any amount of money that would make me have more kids than I otherwise wanted to. And I think that's the big problem with a lot of these. Most people, these aren't decisions that you can buy. You know, these are deeply based on deeply held beliefs and values, and they're not the kind of thing that you can easily sway with a little more money. They have shown, you know, to be fair, they have shown that like some of these policies can change the timing of kids. They can make people have kids sooner, but not necessarily have more. And you know, there are some people that some policies might make convince. You know, it's not like literally they don't work on anybody. Like I'm sure that, you know, there are families that might have an extra kid if they got free childcare, but it's just not ever enough to make any sort of difference except for on the margins. You know, like it's not making any wide scale difference.
I know, I believe this was my birth announcement. I was born in 1963, so it was the end of the baby boom. The birth announcement, it had a picture of a baby with a diaper and a stamp on the diaper saying another tax deduction, which is kind of, you know, a kind of early natalist kind of policy, right? I don't think my parents took seriously, you know, the cost of children or how much money they might get out of it. And I know in my own experience, and again, you know, we can't mistake this for kind of data or random controlled studies or anything like that. But the idea that you would be able to pay people to have more kids, it seems kind of, you know, it's just not going to work. And Liz, in your piece, you do point to a number of places where it shows the timing of children, you know, changed in some of these studies, but it really did not increase the overall amount. Scott, talk a little bit about the earned income tax credit and some of the other tax policies that have been tried that are, you know, considered child friendly or family friendly. And do they have the effects, the intended effects, or is it mostly kind of rewarding people for decisions that they were going to do anyway?
Yeah, I don't know of good research that shows that they have moved the needle, you know, in terms of people that wanted to have another child being, you know, incentivizing them to have more kids. I think, you know, the child tax credit is something that goes pretty high up the income scale. So you can be a married couple making $400,000 a year and still get the maximum child tax credit per child. I think there probably are some families, you know, that switched from being two worker families to being one worker families and having one of the parents stay at home. That's a sort of explicit goal that a lot of social conservatives have for the program, I think. But I've not seen any evidence to suggest that it's affected fertility. The EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit that you mentioned, is more of an anti-poverty program than the child tax credit is. It phases out a lot sooner. It's targeted much more towards the working poor. And I don't know of good evidence there that has also increased fertility, but it does sort of raise, I think, what ought to be a real concern for a lot of the pronatalists who generally think that these incentives are going to increase the number of kids being raised by married parents. Maybe it's going to increase the number of kids in married parent families with one parent at home. But to the extent that they target folks lower down on the income ladder, they could also increase fertility in ways that maybe they haven't thought about. Non-marital fertility, unintended fertility, teen fertility, it really raises the question of is all fertility something that we want to encourage, the policy wants to encourage? And it's really relevant. There's good research showing that the decline in fertility since the Great Recession is overwhelmingly a decline in non-marital fertility. So it's not that married couples are having fewer kids, it's that single mothers are having fewer kids. Over half of it is a decline in unintended fertility. So, you know, do we wish that we had had more unintended births since 2007? That's a big open question.
That's a fascinating kind of question, too, of like, you know, one of the ways, you know, if you, you know, to paraphrase Willie Sutton, who, you know, robbed banks because that's where the money is. Do you want to go back to a world in which teenagers are having more kids,
right? Because the teen birth rate is way down. That's a huge part of this too. Is it's just dropped so drastically.
Yeah, it's such a triumph. I mean, I think until about 1970 that it was typical that, you know, a first live birth was to a woman who was 20 or younger. That has aged up. And it also seems, particularly with social conservatives who are often obsessed with, you know, issues of grooming and things like that, we have effectively desexualized adolescence and young adulthood or late teen years, which would seem to be a win. But then it's like, okay, well, you know, why aren't kids having more sex or more births? It gets confusing very quickly. What is the, you know, what is the way to speak to people on the left to kind of not worry so much if we're not having as many kids as we need in order to make Medicare for all, you know, a glorious reality?
Well, I think, you know, I think the easiest message to them, you know, which conservatives would immediately react to, I think, is, you know, you ought to be advocating for just stronger immigration, you know, if that's, or higher levels of immigration, if that's your concern. Beyond that, I think, you know, the sort of, to the extent that fertility is something that the left worries about, I think it's just one facet of a bigger sense of doomerism. You know, it's just another example of like why the economy is failing everybody and why we need UBI. So in some ways, I think progressives come at it from a little bit of a different perspective, where I think the main thing they're concerned about is just how terrible late capitalism is. And this is just another example of that. Whereas the conservatives come at it from like, this is a problem of itself. It's more important than economics.
And it's kind of fascinating that libertarians, Liz, are like, yeah, you know, I mean, when you say like no amount of money is going to move you to do something, like what kind of libertarian are you that you can't put a price tag on that third child?
It's funny too, though, because like a lot of times I've been asked like several times after writing this, you know, like, well, so what if it doesn't raise fertility? Like, isn't it a good thing in and of itself to, you know, make lives easier for parents and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you know, this can't answer that question. Like that depends on your political values. Like the left is going to say, yes, you know, we should give people paid, you know, leave and subsidized childcare and all this stuff anyways, just because we should. You know, libertarians are going to say no, because the government's going to muck it all up and make it more expensive. So I think, you know, yeah, like the question of fertility alone doesn't settle whether or not that is good policy, which is like a weird thing. People want it to settle.
Yeah. And it does seem, I mean, kind of thinking about some of the stuff that Scott was talking about, you know, I don't think it's late capitalism. I, you know, since I was in grad school in the late 80s, I've been hearing about late capitalism, which after the collapse of communism became advanced capitalism. And now it's back to late capitalism. So maybe this time it actually is the beginning of the end. But it's certainly the end of the entitlement state as we know it. I mean, these, you know, Social Security, Medicare seem unsustainable in any in the current form they're in. And then the question is, how much do you kind of bilk the younger generation to pay for the older generation? How much do you means test people out of these programs and things like that? But it seems to be a kind of fundamentally different question than just having more kids so that you have future taxpayers, which was, Scott, were you part of the Reformicon movement or whatnot? But that seemed to be a popular position on the right to say, you know, what's good about kids is that they are future taxpayers. And it was kind of this grim human calculus of, you know, we need to be having more kids because we're going to need more taxpayers by the time I'm ready to go on Social Security.
Yeah, that was definitely, I mean, so first, yes, I am a living specimen of a Reformicon who will even own up to it. So I think among the Reformicons.
Yeah, the Reformicons are kind of like the Sith Lords or something in Star Wars, right? Except not quite as successful or ultimately deadly. So that's good.
Yeah, I think we're associated, fairly or not, with Jeb Bush and the famous report after the 2012 election about how Republicans needed to go after more diverse constituents and ignore the populists, and had a very happy ending, as we all know. But the child tax credit, I think, was the main thing that the Reformicons were pushing, and they were pushing it, I think, with this argument that the people who had kids were sort of doubly taxed. They were taxed themselves to support entitlements, and then because they were burdened with having the kids and raising the kids who would support entitlements down the road, that was a second tax. I never loved that argument, but it certainly was quite popular. And I think as we saw after Trump was elected, and the Reformicon group, I think, sort of splintered a little bit into the more pronatalist social conservative side and others, was that there really was this desire to increase fertility because kids are good. I think because we needed to offer something to the middle class. And it was in real tension with kind of more libertarian points around, you know, well, if people can afford the costs of their decisions, they should favor them.
Because in the Reformicon argument too, it was kind of like, I don't know, these kids just showed up. Like, the people who had kids, there was no sense of agency that, well, you know what, I chose to have children who are a cost on society as well. You know, and yeah, down the road, maybe they'll pay in taxes and whatnot, but it was a kind of interesting obfuscation of like, well, where did all these kids come from that I now need more money in order to, you know, live a life worth living? Can I ask Scott for you, and I'll go to you, Liz, after that, on the kind of more broad moral or ethical question, should the state be in the business of saying you should have more kids or you should have fewer kids? You know, there's and Liz touches on this in her story, because of overpopulation in China, you know, they had the one child policy in place for decades, which is a disturbing, you know, I mean, beyond disturbing, apparition. And it's similar to various kinds of eugenics programs, like, you know, but that's a negative thing. But is it kind of morally the same thing to say the state should be geared towards people having more kids or fewer kids? And is the problem that the state should not be putting its thumb on the scale? Not that it can actually change behavior, but even the gesture is questionable.
Yeah, I think that's certainly the case. I think, you know, a very quick way to upset a social conservative is to sort of make an argument along the lines of, like, there are two families that each make $100,000. One of them, you know, buys a boat. One of them, like, decides to have a kid. We should not. It's not the role of government or policy to favor or disfavor one of those. And I do believe that. I'm a little bit more paternalist probably than you guys in some ways. So I think all the policy debate about fertility is just misguided. I wish there were more of a debate around marriage incentives. And in part, I can justify that because currently government policy disincentivizes marriage in a variety of ways, especially for poor Americans.
What are those? And then, what are some of the ways that it does that?
So much of our safety net programs are, the eligibility is based on family income. And so this is true if you take a job and your income goes up, your benefits go down. But if you marry your boyfriend or your girlfriend, her benefits stand to go down if she's getting food stamps or housing benefits. And those are real, those are very clear financial disincentives. You can talk to people getting these benefits and they will tell you, like, I can't do that because I'll lose my housing subsidy. So there are things we could do with the Earned Income Tax Credit and the Child Tax Credit to try to counter some of those disincentives that I would favor and that I've actually proposed, you know, sort of expanding the Earned Income Tax Credit for married couples, for instance.
Why is marriage a good thing in and of itself? Why is that something that the state should encourage rather than be neutral on?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked that. I was talking about single parenthood earlier. Like, I've been a single parent myself, so I'm not somebody to sort of finger wag. But there's just a ton of research showing that kids who grow up with two parents do better on dozens of outcomes than kids who grew up with a single parent on average. I think people whose own parents, you know, had split up or whose kids have been raised separately are probably, you know, that seems more obvious to them than it does to, I think, a lot of people who are sort of like, who are we to say, you know, what family structure ought to be. So to my mind, I think just for kids' opportunity, for upward mobility out of poverty, for kids' happiness levels, you know, encouraging more happily married two-parent families would be a good. It would also actually, if probably indirectly, help fertility as well, because one of the, I think, biggest reasons, although maybe Liz would disagree with this based on her research, one of the biggest reasons fertility has declined is that people marry later. And so they right. lose some years, you know, where maybe some of them would be having kids.
And they might marry sooner if it didn't disadvantage them in tax policy or transfer payments.
Yeah, that would sort of be the argument. Yeah.
Liz, what do you think? Should the state, you know, will you take a bold stand right now, Liz, and say, I'm rejecting, you know, the child tax credit for my second kid? You're going to be a prisoner of conscience. You know, refuse it.
No.
But should you, I mean, how do you approach that, the idea, you know, and, you know, and this goes to a kind of question of libertarian paternalism, I suppose, where people like Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler said, you know what, there's going to be incentives built into every kind of policy. Why not tip them in ways that make more sense, or, you know, that are kind of better for society, recognizing that it's always hard to determine that. But should this state be encouraging or discouraging any kind of family formation, any kind of, you know, kind of personal living situation?
I mean, no, I don't think so. I don't think that's fair to prioritize, any particular lifestyle over another, because, you know, those are matters of people's values and choices, or sometimes they're not, you know, sometimes they're just matters of circumstances, and we shouldn't be penalizing people one way or the other because of the way that they're either the decisions they made or the way that their life turned out in that capacity. I do think it's interesting just to, you know, kind of get at one of the things Scott mentioned about, you know, this should be a marketing campaign for conservatives. You know, this is because this is a matter of values and the things you were talking about with the 1950s too. You know, like, I read recently that the divorce rate is actually lower now than it has been in, I think, like 5 decades. And, you know, I was saying that to someone, a social conservative recently, and they were like, well, yeah, but that's because fewer people are getting married in general. So, like, you know, we're still having less marriage. And I'm like, yeah, but again, like, this is how are we looking at it? Like, do we want people just to be getting married just because, or do we want people to be getting married that are more wanting to get married and able to be in happy marriages? The same thing with fertility. And I think we can argue that, you know, because we have more choice in these matters, because we've loosened these cultural constraints around the idea that everyone has to get married and everyone has to have kids, the people who are doing it are a lot more stable, are a lot happier, are going to produce happier, you know, individuals and happier families and better well-adjusted children.
I think that it's fascinating to think about. On the right, there is a broad, you know, and there's a broad discontentment with the choices that people are making, because no, I want people to get married and have kids and be younger or whatever. On the left, that takes the form of, I just read a great essay called Ugh Capitalism, where it was a critique of left-wingers who just everything that they dislike about the current moment, they just say, oh, that's late capitalism. And it ultimately, you know, we have these broad ideological camps that are just mad at the fact that a lot of people make life choices or have preferences that they don't agree with. And instead of, you know, for me, I mean, the only way out of that for sanity was to kind of be libertarian and be like, you know, we live in an incredibly varied society and world, and that's kind of great. And we're bringing in more types of people and sanctioning people to live and to think and express whatever they believe. And that's all great. And it means like you're going to encounter a lot of stuff that you wouldn't necessarily prefer, but it, you know, for the same reason that they can, you know, dye their hair whatever color they want or live in a throuple or, you know, not get married, it means you have a little bit more space to live the way that you want. And overall, that's pretty good.
Yeah. This makes me think of the Catholic integralists, you know, that want the state to enforce their version of the good life, sort of it somehow the thought never enters their heads, like, you guys are a tiny minority of the population. How would you like to see the rest of the country impose and sort of have the state impose its values on you, which they probably would argue it does to some extent. But I think your point about libertarianism is absolutely well taken here.
Yeah, and that's sort of the bottom line in all of this fertility stuff is just that, you know, when what we've seen in countries with like hugely diverse cultures, political systems, you know, all around the world, and just all these any difference you can imagine, what we've seen is that when you give people the choice to have, you know, the technical ability to have less kids and the choice to have less kids, a large percentage of them are going to take it. People are still wanting to get married. People are still wanting to have kids, but people are wanting to have smaller families. And that's something that, yeah.
It's also true that, like, you know, you're giving people the technological or the technical ability to have kids who wouldn't be able to otherwise. So it's not just, okay, you know, we're not having kids. It's, you know, people who wouldn't have been able to have kids are having them. And that, you know, that doesn't really get discussed very often, which is a shame.
That's one of the things, yeah, that I mentioned briefly at the end of this article too, is like just in the way, you know, possible bright spots in this fertility argument, one, or population decline argument, one, immigration, but two, yeah, just technology. I mean, we've seen so many people be able to have kids that wouldn't have been able to a few decades ago because of things like IVF and other assisted reproduction technologies. And as, you know, those things get even better and less expensive, and, you know, egg freezing, just all sorts of things, like as those things get less expensive and more widely available, I think we will see more people who are maybe struggling to conceive now be able to actually have children.
I worry about, you know, in the same, there's a parallel argument about how, you know, there's so much data, we put so much data out into the cloud and it's going to be weaponized against us. And I always think, I had a Fitbit in like 2011. I have no idea what happened to the data. It's somewhere in the Internet of Things. It's floating out there. But Liz, that's like, you know, these eggs, when they, you know, when people die, or, you know, they're still around, like somebody is, maybe in 1,000 years, we'll stumble across them and create a whole new race of superhumans out of, yeah, you know, it'll be, Scott, as we wrap up, could you talk a little more broadly about, you know, the debate over fertility is one of these great declension narratives that you talk about. And these are things that exist, you know, from human history. I mean, certainly, you know, the Garden of Eden is kind of, you know, Adam and Eve are kind of, it's the first declension narrative in a very particular way within a kind of Christian worldview. But in the colonies, the American colonies, you know, certainly in the 20th century and the 21st century, we are rife with declension narratives. Everybody knows only one thing, which is that things today are worse than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 100 years ago. And certainly, you know, the decline in fertility is always framed in that way. What is there an underlying dynamic to, like, when you go through phases where it seems like people are more, you know, declinist than they used to be?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know that I have a good answer to that. I think your point that it sort of is always there is right. I sort of, you know, my limit, maybe this reflects my age. I was born in 1973. But so I sort of think of in the 1980s, you know, there were all these arguments that Japan was going to eat our shorts. You know, in the 1990s, the recession was described as this white collar recession, you know, that was hitting even the middle class and upper middle class.
The worst one since the Great Depression.
Which turned out to be, you know, about as right as, you know, the Xi session from 2020 was. You know, and then there was like the WTO and the rise of China and the China shock. And there's some, it's certainly true that China being a bigger economic power has had some costs, and it's had a lot of benefits as well. But it's sort of just this constant thing that shifts. Occupy Wall Street and around the financial crisis and the Great Recession, millennials
and the Tea Party. If we're being honest, the Tea Party was a form of declension narrative as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So it has. it has been around for a long time. I think social media has made it worse. I think, you know, maybe the millennials have maybe an undeserved reputation as being especially whiny because like social media was around for them to whine on. Whereas when Generation X, when Douglas Copeland's book came out, you know, there it was just a book that few people read. So I don't know what it is psychologically. You know, we are inclined to think that the good old days were always good. I think there's an element in our media of if it bleeds, it leads. And so there's a bias there towards pointing out all the things that are going wrong. And there's a lot of bad statistics out there and a lot of people who think their job, either as social scientists or journalists or policymakers, is to find, you know, the problems that need to be addressed. And if you go looking for the problems, you'll find them one way or another. Yeah.
I know some of the stuff that you've done at AEI, at the Center on Opportunity and Social Mobility, is to debunk the idea that younger people don't have any upward mobility or any options. And part of it, you mentioned a version of this. You know, when you look at GDP per capita rather than just GDP, I mean, with millennials, for instance, actually are doing pretty well when you look at millennial income per capita and pegged against where their parents were at the same age. So that, you know, I'm becoming more and more obsessed with what Irving Goffman, the sociologist, called frame analysis, that, you know, we are just applying the wrong frame to so many issues. But then it becomes that question, and I think about this, my parents who were born in the 20s to immigrant parents, grew up poor in the Depression, World War II, they would talk a lot about, you know, the difference between 1945 when World War II ended, but they just assumed that their lives were going to be kind of miserable because they had been all along. And, you know, then there would probably be another world war in 15 or 20 years. But by 1950, that seemed to have changed. And even when you look at the Black Civil Rights Movement, people, it was bad, but people felt they were on an upward trajectory. You know, the moral arc of history was bending towards freedom and fairness. And even in my young adulthood, the difference between 1979 or 1980 and 84 was amazing. You know, it's not that people weren't complaining and there weren't a lot of bad things going on, but the general mood had shifted to one of optimism. I think this happened in the 90s as well, despite, you know, Bill Clinton somehow got elected by saying the mild recession of the early 90s was the worst thing since the Great Depression. But by 1996, everybody was doing extremely well. So yeah. I'm curious what goes into those kinds of big flips in a kind of social or national mood.
Yeah, I don't have a good sense of that. I do think the Great Recession, was pretty formative for a lot of millennials. And in some ways, like, the view of late capitalism or whatever, like the switch was never dialed back as the expansion under Obama and then under Trump, now under Biden, has sort of barreled forward.
I think, it's funny because we do a lot of like debunking of these narratives too at Reason. And whenever we do, you know, you'd think people would be happy to learn that things aren't as bad as they seem in this horrible view. And instead people get really mad and really defensive about it. And it's always very interesting to me that everyone sort of clings to this, you know, things are worse than they are view. My totally like unscientific speculation here is it seems like, you know, for some older people, like their lives are not as good as they would like them to be or are not where they wish they'd be. So it, you know, is beneficial for them to believe that that is because society has gotten worse. And for a lot of younger people, or youngish, because millennials are not young anymore, there's this sort of yearning to live in interesting times and this feeling that our parents and people before us all had these much more dramatic, you know, fights to fight and we don't have that. So people want to have that. And so they're sort of obsessed with this idea that actually we are in these worst times and it is, you know, existential and we are fighting fascism and all this stuff because it makes them feel better about their sort of place in history or their own, you know, self-importance, even though I don't think anyone would describe it like that consciously, right. But it seems like there's some of that going on.
Yeah. Liz, you are a millennial, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. What could you, and I realize it's terrible to put you on the spot this way, but how does the issue of climate change, but climate catastrophe, how does that fit into your worldview? And obviously you're sui generis to begin with, and you work at Reason and whatnot, but it seems to me that the climate apocalypse, which is something that, you know, has been an ongoing kind of narrative that's been pushed. And, you know, and I'm not saying it's completely wrong or whatever. It's just, that was a background story, which seems to be fading a little bit. But is that part of the general kind of milieu in which you grew up, where it's almost like no matter what you do, it doesn't really matter because by the time you're 50, the planet is going to be a burnt cinder?
That feels to me like a very like extremely online person or very highly educated sort of certain type of neurotic progressive idea, because like, no, that is not only never been like my sense, but also like, you know, I'm around not just libertarians, not just, you know, just I'm around a vast different variety of sort of socioeconomic classes. Well,
you are living in the real America.
Yeah.
Ohio, the heart of it all. I mean,
yeah. It's like, yeah. People don't seem to really feel like that's a, I mean, it's not saying that people aren't necessarily worried, but like, there's not this like doom about it but I am always surprised then to see certain people arguing online or in the media that like, well, obviously millennials aren't having kids, or obviously we're not going to do this because how could we bring a kid into the world with climate change? And you know, yeah, there are people who fervently believe that, which is always a little bit like, I'm like, wow, that exists.
I remember an episode of All in the Family. It must have been in the early 70s where Mike Stivic and Gloria, you know, Meathead, Rob Reiner, and, you know, they're telling Archie, like, how could they possibly bring a kid into the world because of, you know, starvation in China and the Cold War and this and that. And it's like, you know, like, there's always more arguments for not bringing kids into the world, right? And it's never the right time to have a kid, right? So, but it seems like
nobody ever says, boy, I wish I hadn't been brought into this terrible world.
Catch me. It's Wednesday. By Friday, you talk to me about that and I'll have a different opinion. But, you know, I guess, you know, Scott, final question for you and then one for Liz, but in terms of the debate over natalist policy or more broadly, I guess, kind of social engineering through government policy and tax code, is that becoming worrying to you? I think you are old enough. I certainly am to remember when that was the argument that conservatives and people at places like the American Enterprise Institute would make against Democrats and liberals. And they would say, you know, they are trying to do social engineering through the tax code or through public policy, and that's wrong. Has that changed on the broadly construed right? And does that worry you?
I think there's been a rift that's opened up since 2015, 2016, where I think you've sort of seen, you'll call them the national conservatives or the national populists. They have adopted a lot of the same critiques that progressives have had for years now in terms of the economy contributing to, you know, whatever they don't like about today. It's sort of because of features of the economy, trade, immigration, the financialization of the economy that need to be fixed in service of these values they have that they believe, you know, are maybe more widely shared than they are. I think a lot of that message has been attractive to a lot of social conservatives. And so you've just seen the base of the Republican Party, for sure, which you can argue whether they're conservatives or not, but clearly that base is very much populist, very much wants the government's hands off their Medicare, and you know, adopts a lot of these other progressive friendly positions. I do think there is, I hope it's not a remnant, you know, as Jonah Goldberg puts it sometimes, of sort of more principled traditional conservatives who are holding fast to the positions that were more common in the 1980s, but it's certainly kind of the central split, I think, on the right these days.
Thank you. Liz, in terms of kind of natalist policy and feminism, can you briefly touch on, do you feel within the libertarian movement, you know, and I know you're one of the co-founders and heads of Feminists for Liberty, which is trying to, you know, kind of grow the understanding of individualist feminism and whatnot. Do you find that message is growing, or is there also, I mean, I guess maybe it mirrors a split on the conservative right of people who call themselves libertarian or are libertarian and seem increasingly hostile to feminism or to kind of, you know, increased autonomy for women and the choices that they make?
Yeah, I don't know if it's growing or if it's just getting more vocal, but like you know, as sort of, as you said, mirroring the split with the conservatism, it's been the big split within libertarianism about whether or not, you know, libertarians in their forward facing capacity should be tolerant of various lifestyles and, you know, sort of say like, yes, the beauty of libertarianism is that it allows people to live all these different ways, which is what I think, you know, as much as, you know, I think that women's autonomy and everything is great. You know, I'm not going to tell people like, oh, you need to, you know, live your life. You need to have your relationships in this model. You need to have your family being raised in this model. Like, I think that that's, you know, an important thing that everyone needs to figure out for themselves. But there definitely is this strain of libertarianism that's getting louder, that at least on the internet, not that I really encounter in real life, that very much believes like, no, actually, like we should take explicitly socially conservative positions. You know, we're not necessarily saying the state should, you know, mandate these, but we should definitely pick a side in the culture war and argue that really strenuously, which I think is, you know, that obviously libertarians are going to have lots of different positions in the culture war. And I'm not saying we should be quiet about them by any means, but I do think that it's a bad idea for libertarianism as a whole to sort of make that central to our project to pick a side in the culture war, you know? And I think that's one of the things you'll find with Feminists for Liberty is that while we are stressing, you know, certain positions, we are very much still holding the libertarian line of, you know, it takes all, you know, we want women to be able to make their own choices. We want people of all genders to be able to make their own choices. We don't want to force these decisions on anybody.
Yeah. Thank you. We're going to leave it there. I've been talking with Liz Nolan Brown of Reason, a senior editor whose cover story is Storks Don't Take Orders from the State. Thanks so much for joining us, Liz. And I've also been talking with Scott Winship, who's a senior fellow and the director of the Center on Opportunity and Social Mobility at the American Enterprise Institute. Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks for having Scott. Me. Very pregnant and points you made.
I think many of them were still born, to be quite honest. But that's you know, I hope this was a fertile conversation for future discussions. We're going to leave it there. Please come back next Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, when it's usually Zach Weismiller and I talking. And thanks for coming out.
This has been the Reason Interview Podcast. Before you do anything else, go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe. There are now 2 Reason interviews a week, and you don't want to miss any of them. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. And while you're at reason.com/podcasts, why don't you check out the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum Debates, our other weekly or monthly podcasts that are great. Thanks for listening.